From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Somerville says it's opening a supervised drug consumption site.
What I'm more worried about and what keeps me up at night is the ever-expanding opioid epidemic. That's what motivates me and others, all our allies and stakeholders, to really move forward on this plan.
But should it? We'll take your calls. Also today, the rising cost of water. It's leaving many state residents struggling to pay the bill.
You know, water is a fundamental right, and it's a fundamental need. And it's not an area where you can really skimp. And that there's a basic equity issue here that we need to be anticipating and thinking about.
Plus, ice cream made completely from plants?
We wanted a better ice cream, one that tasted better, used better ingredients, and was better for the earth. And using your sort of traditional dairy and egg combination isn't necessary.
Turns out it's delicious. We'll learn how to make it next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone is vowing to open a supervised drug consumption site in that city next year. Here he is speaking to WBUR this morning.
We're in the midst of an epidemic, and our goal is to reduce harm and save lives.
Some public health advocates say such facilities allow medical professionals to monitor illegal drug use and potentially prevent overdoses, saving lives. But they violate both federal and state law. On Radio Boston earlier this year, U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, vowed to oppose and shut down any supervised consumption site.
I want everyone to be very clear about this. Not only would it be illegal to open one, but we would pursue enforcement if they did open one.
And in a statement to WBUR today, Lelling said, quote, if Somerville opens one, federal enforcement will follow. So now it seems that the city and the federal government are on a collision course over supervised consumption sites. What do you think? Should Somerville open a supervised consumption site? What about Boston or your town? Is this the right path forward to deal with the region's overdose crisis? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now on the line is the mayor of a neighboring community, Mark McGovern from Cambridge. Mayor McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us on the line is Dr. Laura Keough. She's the medical director of the Substance Use Disorder Bridge Clinic at Mass General Hospital and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She's also the secretary of the Massachusetts Society of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Keough, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mayor McGovern, I want to start with you. We heard Mayor Joe Curtatone there from Somerville and U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling. Do you support what your fellow mayor is doing in Somerville?
I do. In fact, I was one of two mayors on the State Harm Reduction Commission that looked at this issue. I traveled to Montreal to look at the safe consumption sites that they operate, and I think that this is a harm reduction strategy that we absolutely should pursue.
So will Cambridge be joining Somerville in pursuing this?
Well, I hope so. I'm a little jealous of my mayor across the border there. In Cambridge's form of government, these kinds of decisions really fall mostly in the hands of the city manager. So I have been working with the city manager, advocating with the city manager. If it were up to me, we would pursue this matter. But unfortunately, I don't get to make that decision unilaterally. So, you know, we will continue to look at it. We have done a lot of work trying to address the opioid crisis in our city. And this is one strategy I hope that we pursue.
So, Mayor McGovern of Cambridge, just to be clear, if you were able to do it, you would?
Yes.
And as we heard at the top, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling has promised to crack down on those sites. Does that worry you at all?
Well, you know, there are numerous examples throughout our history where issues have to be decided in the courts. And, you know, depending on who you, I am not an attorney, but depending on who you ask, there are some attorneys who feel that the law being used to, that Lelling is using is not necessarily correct in this case. And so that would be something that the lawyers would have to battle out. But, you know, sometimes that's the way it, you know, it has to be. So, you know, we need cities to step up and be willing to lead that charge. They're doing it in Philadelphia, and now they're going to be doing it in Somerville, and I support them.
So, Mayor McGovern, though, what do you say to residents who might be concerned about these types of facilities coming into places like Cambridge or Somerville or even Boston?
Well, I know it's counterintuitive, right? If this is not something that you've looked into and you've read the evidence and you've really spent time studying, it seems like, why would you provide a safe place for people to use drugs? Aren't you encouraging that? But really, when you look at the evidence, that is not accurate. It's not an accurate perception. So we have to, there needs to be a public education campaign to help people really understand why these sites are beneficial. And so, you know, this is about harm reduction. You can't get someone into treatment if they're dead. And I hate to be so crass, but that's what we're talking about here. And there has never been an overdose death in a safe consumption site. And so, you know, this is a harm reduction strategy. It is not the only solution. This is a complex issue that's going to take many pieces of the puzzle to put together, but this is one of them. And we would have to really work hard to educate people to understand why this is important. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to be bold in addressing this issue. People are dying every day. And, you know, if we're not willing to sacrifice and to support these types of programs, then we're not really serious about trying to address this issue.
Well, in terms of being serious about addressing this issue, I want to turn to Dr. Laura Keough. She's the medical director of the Substance Use Disorder Bridge Clinic at Mass General Hospital. Dr. Keough, you've been listening here. From a medical perspective, do these facilities work and how?
Yeah, the data is clear. These facilities do work, and it's the one enormous gaping hole in our continuum of substance use disorder care. And it's really inspiring to hear Mayor McGovern speak to this and so eloquently outline what we know. This is, an intervention I think we need to echo him is to double down on the education efforts. I think a lot of the resistance to this is that so many people just don't understand that these are actually medical facilities. These are very non-judgmental, open access, low threshold opportunities for people to come who have historically not been welcome in more traditional treatment models or other settings, where they can come in at any stage of their illness, they can be welcomed, they can be supported, and not only that, not only can they be saved if they do have an overdose within the facility, but it's an opportunity for people to speak to them about their goals of care and hopefully help to navigate people along the pathway to healthier living, be that to eventually abstinence or to safer drug use. And really what supervised consumption sites do is they actually reflect very beautifully the natural history of what we know about substance use disorder, that this is a chronic, meaning we don't have cure for it. We have excellent treatments. It's a relapsing illness. And at times of relapse or of active illness, that's when people are in crisis and that's when they need the most help at whatever stage we can get to them. And the biggest risk they have is that this is a disease of deep isolation and shame, and people are using alone. So they need have a place where they can be with people who understand this and want to help them.
Dr. Keough, if I may, we actually have some tape here of U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling, who says he's not convinced by the science.
I am not an expert in public health. And when I look at them, it's not clear that studies find, or reliable studies find, a consistently positive effect.
And so, Dr. Keough, when you say it works, are we strictly mm-hmm. speaking about mortality, or are we talking about the addiction crisis at large?
Yeah, I think we're talking about both. And I think Mr. Lelling said it. He's not an expert in this. And I think that the experts have shown in other countries that have supervised consumption sites that not only do they decrease overdose, these are overdose prevention, they save lives, they also decrease the risk of soft tissue and bloodborne illness, of spread to the community, HIV, hepatitis C. They do show that around the communities, there's an increase in public safety and a decrease in crime and a decrease in disposal of syringes that are very bothersome to the communities. And they do show an increase of access to care for people who do come through supervised consumption sites. So the data that we have does show that. And I do think, again, this is really a call for action, as the mayor said, that we really need to help to really educate, to demystify this. You know, harm reduction measures, it's the scaffolding of all medical care that we provide to people for every other chronic relapsing illness that we have. And so if we can look at substance use disorders through the lens of other chronic relapsing illnesses, it really demystifies it. And this is not that far out.
Right.
So I think that's a piece that we can work on.
1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Should Somerville, Cambridge, maybe your city or town, open a supervised consumption site? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Boston City Councilor Michael Flaherty joins us now on the line. Councilor Flaherty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you, Dr. Keough, for your work in this space.
So Councilor Flaherty, you've been listening in. What's your take?
Obviously, I'll agree with harm reduction saves lives, because when you overdose, there's a healthcare professional right there to help revive you. My concern, and I'll defer to the professionals here, is that I want to ensure that there are paths to recovery for participants. I'd like to hear about the success stories of those that frequent safe injection sites, that have gotten clean and sober and have turned their life around. I know that from the city's perspective, we're doing the best we can. We need to look at sort of short, medium, and long-term goals. The fact that the Long Island shelter and that whole bridge debate is conservatively probably 5-6 years away. And then we also know that the safe injection sites are they're federally banned under the Controlled Substance Act, so that's going to be courts and litigation as well. So what are we doing in the short term? And I'm been a strong proponent of treatment on demand. We need more beds. We need more detox and recovery facilities. And we need our suburban counterparts to step up. It's always falling on the shoulders of Boston and Cambridge and Somerville. We need more folks to realize that it's their children, it's their residents as well, and help us site detox and recovery facilities in their respective communities. And
so Councilor Flaherty, do you think Boston should join Somerville in doing this, or do you think
the
communities outside
of
the city should do it?
Yeah, I think Boston's doing their fair share. I mean, just take I'm due to take a tour next week. You guys are more than welcome to join me over there, tour of Mass and Cass and the whole Newmarket area. But we have a Hope, which is at 774 Albany Street. I'm sure the doctor is aware of it, that we have a walk-in clinic as well as a mobile unit that provides tremendous resources. Plus, we have the methadone clinic, the Suboxone. So I think Boston's doing its fair share on the subject matter. We need our suburban counterparts to step up and join us in the fight against the opioid crisis. Mayor Curtatone was right in the onset. It's no longer, it's not a Boston problem. It's not a Cambridge problem. It's not a Somerville problem. It's not even a regional problem. This is a national epidemic.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Dr. Keough, I'll get to you in just a second here, but I want to take a couple of calls. Elizabeth is calling from Somerville. Elizabeth, you're on Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to say I think this is a great idea. I'm very excited that Mayor Joe is leading in this. I think it's really necessary. Everything I've read about it sounds really positive. This is a real problem in Somerville and throughout the area. I think that, I'm entirely in favor. I think it's great.
Okay, Elizabeth from Somerville, thanks for that call. I want to take another call here, Bob from Peabody. Bob, you're on Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'd like to ask these people, you have a lot of people that want these needle places in there. Will they put it next door to their house? Because I did lose a godson and a nephew to the opioid crisis, and I've lost friends to the opioid crisis. When people just come on the radio and say these are great ideas, would they put them next door to their houses?
Well, Bob, I hear the pain in your voice, and I'm so sorry for your loss. And I do think your experience reflects the experience of many people here in New England. So thank you for sharing it. And, I'm going to put your question, Bob, to to our guests, Mark McGovern, Mayor of Cambridge.
I think Bob has a very fair point.
And sorry, can you identify yourself? We've got three phone guests here, so all right, Councillor Flaherty. Go ahead.
I think that Bob has a great point. Interesting enough that the safe injection sites had been proposed, I believe, by suburban legislators, a suburban state rep and a suburban state senator. That's the question I had. If we're going to have one, let's start in their respective community. It's great to have the great idea, but then it's going to get dumped on Boston or Cambridge or Somerville. And I think therein lies the issue, that we're in a crisis that we need all hands on deck, and we need suburban communities to recognize. We just had the issue over at Mass and Cass, over the Newmarket area, where they had two or three days of arrest, almost three-quarters of the folks weren't even from Boston. That sort of speaks to the issue here, is that, you know, Boston is doing its fair share. The mayor and the city has never committed more funds to recovery in the history of the city, and I'd put us up against anyone with respect to what we're putting on the line in terms of recovery. And I'll speak from a personal perspective. My cousin was a frequent flyer over at the Newmarket area, and his exact words were that if we had safe injection sites, he would push the limits of his high. And unfortunately, we lost him recently to an overdose. But that's his perfect situation, that he had no interest in getting recovery, that he would he was looking forward to the safe injection sites opening up so that he could push the limits of his high, maybe even introduce fentanyl. And therein lies the concern that I have, is we need to be focused on pathways to recovery for all participants. And if there's no pathway to recovery via the safe injection sites, I'm going to have major concerns with it being in Boston. However, I open up to the science, I open up to the professionals, and would even open up to other communities stepping up to the plate and offering solutions.
Well, Councillor Flaherty.
Can I jump in?
Yes. I just want to say again, Councillor Flaherty, I'm sorry for your loss there. And again, I think your experience speaks to the experiences of many of our listeners. Mark McGovern, Mayor of Cambridge, and then I do want to get to Dr. Laura Keogh as well. Go ahead, Mayor McGovern.
So, couple things. My family has lived in the same house in Cambridge for 100 years this year. I still live there with my kids. We are a direct abutter to Cambridge's needle exchange program, which opened in the mid-90s. And so to answer Bob's earlier question, would you want this next to your house? It is next to my house. And when the needle exchange program moved in and they were going to be providing needles to active drug users, we did not fight it. We understand that it needs to be located somewhere, and we understand it's a program that helps people. And my kids, I have 9-year-old twins that get off the school bus every day, that lets them off in front of that program. And we have never had an issue. We have never had a problem. So if that's where it gets located in Cambridge, I am a direct abutter and I would support it. And that's where we need people to step up. And to Councillor Flaherty's point about suburban communities, you know, we can't keep talking about how we have to solve the problem. We have to solve the problem. And then when we're asked to put our chips on the table, push them over and say, well, let somebody else do it.
Dr. Laura Keogh, medical director of the Substance Use Disorder Bridge Clinic at Mass General, I'd like you to weigh in here.
Yeah, I'd love to speak especially to the question of treatment pathways. You know, one thing that was mentioned was about wanting to see people who get better. And I can tell you, I run a low threshold immediate access treatment on demand program, and we get many of our referrals from syringe exchange programs, both from Cambridge and AHOPE, and word of mouth off the street, and from the emergency room after people have overdosed or have had really significant horrible consequences of their drug use, and people coming in on their own. So the pathways are there. The greater issue is that the other issue is that access to really immediate, accessible, and evidence-based treatment is also the big elephant in the room, that not everybody is getting to that, and that includes medications like methadone and buprenorphine or Suboxone, but also all pathways. And the message that we spoke a little bit before is, for many people, they are going to get to remission, to full remission, and that would be the goal for everybody for any illness. However, as I said earlier, this illness is punctuated by relapses and by active illness moments or relapses throughout the chronicity of the illness, as is hypertension and diabetes, for example. And so during those times, having supervised consumption sites where people can be safe, and to the comment about your cousin, Councillor Flaherty, I'm so sorry, that also is not so surprising. That's part of the evolution resolution of this illness, there are phases when people are actively using, and that may be ambivalence is, you know, wanting two things at once is really the underscoring of this illness as well. And so it may have been that your cousin was at that stage where many patients are, and that's the exact time we want to see people at a place like that where professionals can work with him to figure out why that is, what else they can do to keep him safe during that period of time when he's using, and hopefully help him navigate along the pathway to greater health as he gets toward whatever works for him and balancing competing priorities and patients' lives.
Well,
but
Dr.
Many
Keogh,
people
it does...
are not speaking to that because of the stigma around this, that they're embarrassed. Even my patients who are actively seeking services from us, getting safe works, getting education about how to stay safe when they're using, are embarrassed to talk about it. And then when they're sober, they particularly may not feel comfortable doing so. So it's hard. We're seeing people in crisis, and we're seeing them often and frequently on the street, but we're not hearing as much from people who are well-seated in remission and recovery or have had experiences that you're looking to see.
Well, and actually, we spoke earlier today to Paul Bowman. He's a member of the Boston Users Union and on the board of the National Alliance for Medication-Assisted Recovery. And here's what he said about why he thinks this is a good idea.
People are using wherever there's a place to use, unfortunately. So if we had a safe place, that at least you'd have less of a chance of maybe a really bad outcome.
So it seems to me this keeps coming back to this idea of preventing deaths and then helping people get over addiction. And so, Dr. Keogh, is that really the core of this issue?
No, I think it is for many people. There's this desire, and understandably, people want to fix this problem, and seeing people who are using drugs makes people feel uncomfortable. The dirty little secret about substance use disorders, and in particular opioid use disorder, is when people get the right care, the majority of them get better. And that's the message that we also need to get
out.
But
do these facilities lead to people getting that care?
Yes, they do. And again, redefining what we are comfortable with and what we know is better and what is health. So if somebody is in a safe consumption site, for example, and they are able to wash their hands, they are able to use sterile equipment, they are able to decrease their risk of getting an infection in their bloodstream that leads to open heart surgery or leads to spreading HIV and hepatitis C or leads to discarding syringes or leads to an overdose, and they can come in and be safely doing that while they're actively using, that's health. And so is the person who then comes to, say, the Bridge Clinic and starts Suboxone and gets recovery coaching and gets their depression treated and we get housed. And so is the person who continues to use during that period, and so is the person who gets to full remission and becomes a recovery coach themselves. Or, you know, so that whole natural history at each point in a person's life, depending on that person's individual needs and competing priorities in their lives, those are all markers of health and the trajectory is up. So looking at it in this black and white abstinence versus homeless and using on the street and overdosing is really missing the mark of what we define as medical providers and experts in this and patients as what health is and what we're looking for. And I think appealing to people who struggle with so much with what active drug use looks like and applying this. We know that this is an illness. We know that we have treatments that work. This is one component of it. But also speaking to the financial impact and the emotional impact, the impact on the Department of Children and Family Services.
Well, and I actually want to bring in someone who has another personal experience with this. Gretchen is calling from Needham. Gretchen, you're on Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So first, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I worked doing some research on different types of psychotherapy support for people in methadone clinics. But that was way before this crisis hit. But the personal story is that one of my brother's best friends growing up became a heroin addict. And he is now 10 years sober, doing well, just got married, living healthfully. But one of the reasons he's living healthfully is that when he was going through his process of atonement and coming clean, he told me that he used to steal my insulin syringes from under the sink at our house. And he said that that was why he never got HIV or hepatitis C, that his life was saved because he had access to clean needles. And so how much more can we help people? There's so much trouble going on right now. So to have this individual personal story of one person who was able to just have clean needles, how many more stories like that can we have from safe injection sites where people are being watched and cared for and getting into the system?
Well, Gretchen, thank you for sharing your story. Again, I can hear the emotion there in your voice, and so I really appreciate you calling in. And I just want to turn to our guests for just final thoughts. We are, of course, as always, flat out of time here. So if we could just have quick thoughts from Mayor Mark McGovern from Cambridge, what's the way forward in just a couple of seconds?
I think it's to open facilities, challenge it in court. We have to remember this is about harm reduction. And it's one piece of a very complicated puzzle, but we need to keep people alive so that they can get the treatment that they desperately need.
That's Mark McGovern. He's mayor of Cambridge. We were also joined this segment by Dr. Laura Keough. She's the medical director of the Substance Use Disorder Bridge Clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Michael Flaherty, Boston City Councilor. I want to thank all of you for joining us, and our callers, thank you for calling and sharing your stories and your experiences on this topic. The opioid epidemic crisis is one affecting so many families. So thank you. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We'll be back after a short break.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Wouldn't it be nice to get a 35% raise, or even better, a 50% raise? Well, some Massachusetts communities have seen just that, but not in their paychecks, on their water bills. And here to explain why this is happening is Martha Davis. She's a professor of law at Northeastern University. She's the lead author of a Northeastern report, A Drop in the Bucket, Water Affordability Policies in 12 Massachusetts Communities. And she's also an expert affiliate of WaterLex, an international NGO focused on protecting the human right to water. Professor Davis, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So you, in this report, analyze the water rates of 12 communities in Massachusetts, including the 10 largest water districts in the state. Briefly, what did you find? I mean, those numbers are kind of staggering.
Yeah, so we didn't look so much at the increase over time in water prices, but more about how the communities were responding to that. So we were looking at the discounts and affordability policies that the cities were adopting in response to this. And what we found was that there's really a sort of narrow set of policies that the cities have adopted. None of the municipalities that we looked at had income-based discounts, which is kind of astonishing given that it's really income that plays the biggest role in whether or not somebody can afford these rising water prices. And then we found, also that some communities are shutting off water when people don't pay. Others have a policy of not doing that but may instead put the water bill over to for a tax lien so that ultimately people might even lose their property. So there are lots of different responses that cities are having, and that's really what we were looking at.
And these are just, again, in these 12
That's
places.
Right.
But I guess one of the big questions that comes to mind for me is why? Why are the water rates seemingly increasing at kind of insane levels?
Yeah. So this is happening nationwide, I should say. So it's not just Massachusetts. And there are a number of reasons. One is that the infrastructure that provides our water service is really aging. It's decades old all around the country, and it's very, very expensive to repair. And until it's repaired, there are lots of leaks and other things that cause, increase in water prices. Ironically, greater successful conservation ends up meaning that our water can go
up. Why is that?
Because if you're utilizing resources to produce a lower level of water and have a lower demand, then the cost per unit is greater. So that's really what it is. So we want to conserve, but it has this ironic impact of increasing water prices. And then climate change plays a role too. You know, as we see more extreme weather events, especially with stormwater charges and sewer charges, as they're flooding and so on, that pollutes the water sources, the cost of dealing with that goes up. up and then increases the water costs as well.
So I want to get back to those two numbers that I mentioned at the top in maybe a bit of a joking manner about getting a raise, but this 50% sewer rate increase in Pittsfield and then the 35% water rate increase was in Winthrop, and we're going to hear from Winthrop's town manager in just a moment. But one of the justifications there, to quote from the town's website, was that the previous rates were insufficient to support budgeted expenses for fiscal year 2018. Seems like jargon, but does that just mean that they were undercharging and our other towns, have they been undercharging? Is that the issue here?
Yeah, I think the issue is that the cost is rising. And as I say, that's happening nationwide. And one estimate is that very soon, by I think 2022, that about a third of the people in the country will not be able to afford water. There are obviously, you know, you're juggling those kinds of bills. And so when you say you can't afford water, it's really looking at what percentage of your income is devoted to paying for your water costs. And the typical standard that's looked at is 4% or 4.5%. And so what we're saying is that a significant number of the people in the country will have water costs that exceed that by 2022. So water costs are definitely rising. And when we looked at this information, we didn't really find any bad actors. You know, it's not that the water managers in these towns are you know, trying to stick it to consumers, but it's really that this is a big challenge that everyone is facing. And our concern was really, as we face this challenge together, what are the values that we're going to be using to decide how much we charge and how we deal with people that really can't afford water. When water is a human right, water is something that everyone needs, and we can't really cut people off and say, sorry, you, who, you know, low-income person, don't get water.
Right. So let's actually turn to the town manager of Winthrop. Austin Faison is on the line. Austin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
So you've been listening in here, and we mentioned that Winthrop's price increase was 35%. There was public protest on the decision to raise rates. What happened in Winthrop?
So many of the items that the previous speaker was discussing are what came up in Winthrop. The price went up. Some individuals chose to conserve, which then ultimately led to the price having to be increased again. This is due to debt that was taken on in the past, as well as the assessment that comes from the MWRA. In terms of the MWRA assessment,
and this is the Massachusetts Water Resource Authority?
Yes, who actually has a facility on right next to Winthrop on Deer Island. Our assessment stays the same from that entity, and that assessment is based off of the three-year average, or the prior 3 years. So even though people are reducing usage in the short term, it's over the long term, which impacts the usage of the municipality in the bigger numbers, essentially.
But what did you say to residents who were upset about this price increase?
You know, I hear them, and I tried to be very sympathetic to it. This was something that when the original rate increase went into place in May of 2018, when the first one was announced, there was a little postscript to it that if usage is decreased, then another increase could be projected for the future. I unfortunately had to then pick up the ball with that one and deal with that increase. And it's not something I wanted to put on the community. There's a lot of changes in a short period of time in terms of their rates. Although I would like to smooth it in the future, this is something that was necessary to pay for the bills that the town had basically already incurred, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
So, Martha, I want to turn to you and ask this question. Some estimates say that, you know, the average person in the U.S. uses something like 80 to 100 gallons of water per day. And, you know, of course, everyone should be able to afford their water, but environmentalists argue we're wasting a lot of water. 80 to 100 gallons a day is a lot of water. Could rising prices really help us conserve water?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you heard, it actually can, in the short term anyway, raise prices. So it may not have that impact. I agree that conservation is something that we should all be trying to achieve. some of that usage is leakage, you know, so that's one thing that we have to consider. And also, you know, we do have, you know, certain standards here in the U.S. and expectations about being able to take a bath, being able to take a shower, be able to take a daily shower. You know, it's really a cultural thing. And so, you know, our concern in doing this report is, are there some people that can no longer afford the kinds of basic, you know, lifestyle choices that we expect to have in a country like the U.S., you know, our water costs going up so much that that's going to be impossible for some sector. You know, many people can still afford water at the prices that they are, even if prices continue to go up. It won't be a major issue. And so it's really for these people that whose incomes are so low that water is making up a sizable percentage of their incomes.
So Austin Faison, the town manager of Winthrop, the water rates, I'm reading that they won't be reassessed until next summer. But what is Winthrop doing to address this affordability issue?
Sure. So one was that announcement of nothing's going to change over the next year. Number two is the infrastructure work that's totally necessary. We have pipes in town that are made of clay. We have
sort of addressing this leakage issue that you were speaking of.
Absolutely. So it's not a huge leakage issue. We go around town constantly looking for leaks. It is just a failing old infrastructure. And we are taking care of a large water sewer drainage project in the Center Business District. It just went out to bid, and that work is going to happen next summer. But we have to fix the infrastructure. We need to make sure that the water that's flowing through our system is clean, but also as secure as possible. And being so close to the ocean, it's a different even level of interaction that we have. And we're always looking for infiltration and things like that. But we are trying to work on our system so that if we don't have to pay for large-scale infrastructure items, then the rates will be able to stabilize. But we just have an enormous amount of infrastructure work to do over the next most likely 10 to 20 years.
That's Austin Faison. He's the town manager of Winthrop. Austin Faison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Martha Davis, professor of law at Northeastern University, you were going to jump in there.
So I just wanted to say that one of the things that's happened also that's contributed to the rising water costs is that the federal government has pulled back considerably in the amount of subsidy and grants and so on that they make available to municipalities to deal with in these kind of infrastructure issues. And mm-hmm. So you have the municipalities bearing the burden of this that where it used to be spread more widely. It's also the case that the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, used to have a program that was much like the heating program that assisted people with low incomes who couldn't afford their water. That program discontinued. And so now, you know, we've got these municipalities with discount programs that are primarily targeted at the elderly, primarily targeted at owners of property rather than owner-occupants rather than renters. And so there are a lot of people that are falling through the cracks with these discount programs that are available, at least in the communities that we looked at, where water costs are rising.
So we actually spoke earlier to Dolores Randolph. She does communications for the Boston Water and Sewage Commission. They explain that about 50% of the cost is due to the rate set by the NWRA, and that the rest goes to direct services and infrastructure projects to improve service. Let's listen to what she said.
The best thing to do is to call us, not to ignore us, in terms of questions or with regard to their bills.
So did you find that as well in the towns that you looked at, that there is support and negotiation and things available to homeowners, renters, whoever is paying water bills?
Yes, it's certainly true that some of the towns we looked at communicated that. Some of them did not. Some of them, maybe you could call, but they didn't encourage it. There wasn't anything on their websites or anything that said, you know, call us to talk. Boston is one of the places that said, please call. The number that they give is called collections, so it's not very friendly sounding, you mm-hmm. know, for people that are having difficulty paying a bill. Our other concern is that there aren't any parameters given for what people can expect in that kind of negotiation. So you're told, call us, we'll work with you, but you don't know what the options are. You're really kind of in the dark. And compare that to one of the other cities we looked at was Philadelphia,
yeah,
where they really spell out kind of here are some of the options. collections. They talk about speaking with a customer service representative instead of a collections agent. So they really try to make it something where people can feel confident, more confident about calling in and trying to work something out.
So in the last just about 30 or so seconds that we have, Martha Davis, professor of law at Northeastern, what would be your message to state and local leaders? We heard from Winthrop there about what to do and how urgent the situation is for people.
I think the situation in Massachusetts is not at the highest urgency that you see around the country, but that, I think, gives us an opportunity to get out in front and lead on this issue. We've got cities like Philadelphia and cities like Portland, Oregon, that have taken a lead in developing equitable programs, and I'd like to see the towns in Massachusetts also being innovative in how to think about this.
That's Martha Davis. She's a professor of law at Northeastern University, and she's the lead author of a Northeastern study called A Drop in the Bucket, Water Affordability Policies in 12 Massachusetts Communities. She's also an expert affiliate of WaterLex, an international NGO focused on protecting the human right to water. Professor Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is WBUR's Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. When I say vegan ice cream, what comes to mind?
It's not real ice cream.
Maybe you thought just that. I certainly did. And that's what Dina Jalal has heard for years. She's the founder of FOMU Ice Cream with a handful of stores in Fenway, the South End, Jamaica Plain, and Alston. And she's the author of a new cookbook, Incredible Vegan Ice Cream. And she says, oh yeah, vegan ice cream is the real deal.
I mean, it's real ice cream. And just because it doesn't use traditional ingredients doesn't mean it doesn't have that like amazing, nostalgic, traditional taste. So even if you're an ice cream traditionalist, you'll taste it and you're like, wow, these are flavors that I forgot existed, because some ice creams have come so far from that, you know?
Jalal says she began thinking about what goes into ice cream when she started her own family. And she noticed a lot of ice creams, even so-called homemade ones, had lots of ingredients she didn't like. Stabilizers, preservatives, artificial flavorings. And that she just wanted to make the ice cream from her childhood better. But is that even possible?
It is. And I'll tell you why. So we wanted a better ice cream. One that tasted better, used better ingredients, and was better for the earth. Just a sort of more, what I like to say, thoughtfully prepared ice cream. So we went sort of back to the core and started making strawberry ice cream with strawberries and actually using cocoa and real chocolates and making our own inclusions. And so people would say, this is like the best chocolate strawberry ice cream I've ever had. And I was like, because it uses real chocolate and real strawberries.
Real ingredients with no animal products. Okay, that's all well and good, but as they say, the proof is in the pudding. So with Dina's help, we set out to make the chocolate pudding ice cream from her cookbook. So we're here in your Alston store.
Yeah.
You've set up a couple of tables here, sort of as if it were a small kitchen countertop.
Yeah.
What do we have here on the counter?
Yeah, so these are sort of some of the basics that you would need to make ice cream at home. Obviously an ice cream maker. Here I have a Vitamix, just because this is what we have. You could use an immersion blender. For most recipes, honestly, a whisk would do just fine.
Do you use a food processor or just a standard maybe blender that you have for margaritas or something?
Absolutely. It doesn't even need to be that strong a mixer. It all depends on how rustic you want your ice cream to taste and the texture and things like that. I've got some measuring cups and measuring spoons. And then I have the ingredients. And just about every recipe starts with a natural coconut milk or coconut cream.
And you have these in just canned. You can get them
absolutely
at the supermarket.
And this is exactly how you want to get it, right? You don't want to get the coconut beverage that you find.
Which is like a whole aisle at some supermarkets.
Absolutely.
Now.
Next to like the almond milk and the oat milk and all the alternative right. milks. This is sort of your, before alt milks were a thing, this like coconut, you know, canned coconut milk or coconut cream was what you would find in the can, maybe in like a ethnic food aisle where you would use it for curries or maybe even to blend it in a drink or something. But this is your straightforward, real deal coconut milk. And this is what's going to make the creamy ice cream. All the fat, all the creamy goodness, that's what makes the ice cream. And then we have organic unrefined cane sugar. And so that's pretty much the second, you know, big ingredient in almost all the recipes. Agave. So the different sugars sort of add to the mouthfeel and the texture and the creaminess of the ice cream. So we do a little bit of a sort of a liquid sugar here. And then for every recipe, it, you know, what you have on hand is what flavors the ice cream. So those are the core, really, those are the core ingredients in the base of our ice cream.
So that's sort of the base, and then the rest of the stuff is the flavor.
So. The real flavor, yeah. Right? And so here we have a sustainable cocoa. This is very yummy, very rich. I would just use a very high quality cocoa. Everything is a little, like, harmonious little choreography of ingredients, right?
I love the joy that you describe all these ingredients
it's
with.
Great. It's, I mean, it's ice cream. It's ice cream. It's all so
right.
So
can't forget that this is a joyful process. Who doesn't love ice cream?
Absolutely.
All right. So what next?
So the first recipe we're going to start with that is actually the chocolate pudding. And this, I'm not even a huge, this is like, I know, horrible. People are going to be like, what? I'm not even like a chocolate gal. I'm the gal that goes and gets like the fruit flavors or the spice flavors.
Oh my God, chocolate.
I know, sorry. But this ice cream is literally one of the best chocolate ice creams ever. Like, I will choose this chocolate. It is that good.
For a non-chocolate girl, this is the chocolate.
For a non-chocolate girl. So we are going to open the can of coconut milk. So I'm going to pour this right into my Vitamix. Okay.
Now, you weren't kidding when you said this looks really creamy compared to the coconut drink that you would buy.
Absolutely. So look in there. I mean, that looks like a heavy cream.
Yeah.
So after that, we're gonna measure our unrefined cane sugar, some agave, with our ingredients, and so the last thing that we're gonna add is our cocoa.
Can I smell that?
Yeah.
Mm.
And so when you have our chocolate,
it's a little fruity almost.
There are notes of fruit for sure. So we're gonna put in our cocoa. This is really what's adding that like rich, rich chocolatey flavor. So we're gonna add this to our Vitamix blender bowl. So we're gonna turn this on. We don't even need to mix that long, just enough to incorporate the ingredients. So here we go. It looks pretty smooth and consistent to me. So I think we are good to go. So the next thing we're gonna do is grab our freezer bowl. Pink freezer bowl.
So it looks like a frozen thick aluminum bowl with a paddle that'll spin around.
Absolutely. Yep. What you wanna do is have this moving before you pour your ingredients in, because if you pour it in first, this bowl is so cold that it will immediately stick to it. And so we want it to be moving from the get-go. So we're gonna start our ice cream maker. Let's see. You can hear that going. And then there's this sort of hole in the center. So we're just gonna wanna pour our mix right into the hole. And basically what's happening is, I don't know if you can tell, but that ice cream is freezing to the sides.
Oh, yeah.
And then that scraper is scraping it off. And so it continues to do that for about 15 minutes or so. You want it to really look like either soft serve or really thick frap. So we're just gonna let this go.
And while it churned away, I asked Dina Jalal a little bit about some of the inspirations behind the recipes in her cookbook.
So a lot of flavors are based on, you know, sort of childhood favorites of mine. I'm of Middle Eastern descent. My husband's of Chinese descent. So a lot of them are reminiscent of either ice creams or flavors that we grew up eating. A lot of them draw on drinks we've had or a pie, you know, a pie in Maine. And so all of those draw inspiration, and they have over the years. And I mean, the 60 recipes that are in this book are just a fraction of what we've made over the years.
So this has got just a couple more minutes to go, but my mouth has been watering since I walked in here. So
you mean you don't have like a few hours to?
I gotta try it. Let's go try it.
Let's go try it. All right.
So this is what it would be after you put it into a container and let it sit in your freezer for how many hours?
You could leave it for 3 hours, up to 6 hours. I mean, obviously it's going to store at that temperature. So I would say like 3 to 6 hours would be great. So if you take a look, this is our chocolate pudding. And do you see how, like, rich it's very and dark. Dense that is?
Thank you. It's thick.
It has a chew.
You can really taste the cocoa, that fruitiness that we smelled earlier when we were smelling the cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely taste that.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strongly, in a good way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you'll still
it's
taste,
chocolate.
It is a beautiful chocolate.
And I, you know, I expected to maybe taste some coconut, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least not very strongly. So
mm-hmm.
it's very, like, the chocolate is what...
It is pronounced.
It's pronounced.
Yeah. That's at the forefront, that's for good. Sure.
It's,
yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, I get.
This is good.
You would think after like a decade that I'd be sick of ice cream. It's still my favorite food. I have it in my freezer. We eat it every day.
I don't want vanilla. I don't want chocolate. Bring me some of that good tutti frutti.
Nothing wrong with eating ice cream every day, and as soon as the show's over, we're going to go eat some ice cream that I made from Dina Jalal's cookbook, Incredible Vegan Ice Cream. She's the founder of FOMU Ice Cream. There's more information about her book and a couple of recipes, including the one we made there, and I think a brown sugar corn recipe at our website, radioboston.org. And by the way, we know there are a lot of concerns, both human and environmental, on the impacts of coconut farming. We asked Jalal about this, and she says they absolutely consider these impacts and work with a single sustainable supplier. That's Radio Boston for today. Our show is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hoffi. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.